And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Mary Miller to the program today. Mary teaches at the University of Mississippi and has published 5 books of fiction, including 3 short story collections, the novel, The Last Days of California, and today we'll be talking about her latest novel, Biloxi, which is published by LiveWrite, an imprint of W.W. Norton. Now, Mary, how did Lewis McDonald Jr. find himself at Harry Davidson's house?
So it's just page 1 of the book. Lewis is out. He's taken a little trip to Walgreens to pick up his medicine and a Pepsi. He sees a house and there's a sign that says free dogs and there's some balloons, and he just sort of impulsively stops, and Harry Davidson comes shuffling down the driveway and eventually presents him with a dog.
What's his reason for giving this dog away?
So that's a question that I don't know that it's ever completely answered in the book. So what Lewis is told is that his wife is allergic and he has to get rid of all the dogs but the hypoallergenic ones. It's sort of, and apparently Harry has 14 dogs, so it's kind of a silly premise. You don't know really how many dogs he has back there. Perhaps it's just the one, Layla, that Lewis takes home. So I don't know that Lewis ever gets the full answer to that, because everybody who is involved is a little bit suspicious and shady.
His sense of everything's not quite right here really does come up with Harry.
Yeah. He's very suspicious of Harry, and he doesn't particularly like Harry. Harry leans in, and he can smell the coffee on this guy's breath, and he's really turned off by the guy. And yet, there's something about the dog that he brings out that Lewis really is interested in. He doesn't know exactly why either, because the dog doesn't seem particularly interested in him. The dog doesn't seem particularly bright. He's told that the dog gags a lot and, you know, sometimes throws up bile. So, you know, when Lewis leaves with the dog, I think he's as confused as anyone as to why he felt the need to take her.
Now, there's a strange point of contention in their dickering about whether he's going to take the dog or not. And Harry just wanted to know the man's wife's name, and the guy got his back up.
Yeah. So Lewis is, you know, I think he's very suspicious of the whole deal, and he's wondering. Harry mentions that he's recently married, and Lewis is sort of just questioning who would marry this kind of grotesque man, and he gets really curious about the wife who's not present. And perhaps he's thinking, you know, is this the wife's dog he's giving away? How is the wife involved or not? Am I being told the truth? And so he does. He asks Harry, you know, what's your wife's name? And they become, you know, there's a little conflict there. Eventually they get back to talking about dogs.
Lewis is 63 years old when the book begins, and the only reason he's even thinking about taking a dog, but he has found himself profoundly alone in the world.
He has. He's, at this point in his life, really completely alone. He's divorced from Ellen, who he was married to for, you know, 20-some-odd years, if not 30. He has one daughter, and he's really pretty estranged from her and her family at the moment. And the last member of his nuclear family, his father, has passed away. And he believes that a big inheritance is coming. His father owned a lot of land and had a lot of money, but his father was also a gambler, and the lawyer won't call him back. Anyhow, whether or not the inheritance is coming, he has retired from his job. And so before the novel begins, you really get the sense that Lewis has completely isolated himself and has just been sitting around his house watching reality TV and drinking beer and feeling very sorry for himself.
So how did you choose Naked and Alone as the TV show that he was so fond of?
Naked and Afraid.
Have you seen it? No, I haven't.
So I go to visit my parents, and my dad, oh, I don't know, he would not like this to be a known thing, but is sort of obsessed with this show. And it's just two people who are sent out into the wilds all over America. It's like Survivor, but there are only 2 of them, and they're naked. And they have to stay out there for something like 21 days. They're not given really any food. It's just this show that has so much hardship built into it. Often, you know, they can't find clean drinking water. And I don't know what it is about. My dad just loves sitting in his comfortable chair in his nicely air-conditioned house. my mom might be cooking dinner. He might be having a vodka tonic. But he's watching these people on television just struggle greatly and drop tons of weight. And I don't know. I think it's something just about being comfortable and watching people struggle is all I can figure. The show does not appeal to me that much, but it appeals to my father, who's a little older than Lewis. But I could see him kind of doing the same thing.
You have these people that volunteer to go on the show and go through misery for three weeks. But also, Lewis's misery is pretty much self-inflicted as well.
For sure. Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, another thing about the show, like at Survivor, at least, there was a reward that you could fight for. This show, they never mention a reward, and a lot of people quit their jobs to go on it. So it really is just this bizarre, like, who would do this? And they often come back with just diseases that they have for life. It's wild.
Lewis also, as you said, was going to the pharmacy to pick up some medicine. He's diabetic, and he is not taking care of himself at all.
He's not. I don't know how long it's been. He's completely run out of his diabetes medication, and he eats and drinks just garbage. He's not taking care of himself at all, and he's not getting any sort of exercise. He's just sitting in his recliner. And throughout the book, really, even when the dog sort of gets him back out into the world and he's meeting people and socializing a little more and sort of looking at ways to live a different life, for some reason, he still neglects to get his medicine. He does go to the doctor in the book, though. He has a new doctor. But still, yeah, I think as much as he is maybe trying, there are parts of him that are just sort of, I don't know, still keeping him stuck in the past and not really dealing with his issues.
Yeah, because he's very judgmental of overweight people.
Yeah.
And he's not quite self-aware in that regard.
He's not at all. But he's very judgmental in, you know, just in general. He comments especially toward women. And a lot of people have pointed out, like, why does this guy hate women so much? Which is a good question. But to me, Lewis really seems like an equal opportunity sort of curmudgeon and hater. And even though his political inclinations are Republican, he hates politics. You know, he'll turn on Fox News and he'll watch it, but he's mad about it. And, you know, he comments on, I hate that Tucker Carlson's bow tie on his face. And yeah, he's pretty negative.
Yeah, he's not fond of the most hateful of the Trump supporters out there. He has no time for them either.
No. Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of people that voted for Trump in particular. It just seems like they wanted to kind of stir up the system, you know. And I don't know. His political affiliation, he's probably the type. The coast is a very conservative area. You know, it's a part of him. He's always been a conservative. He's always voted a certain way. And whether he likes the party now or not, he's not going to vote some other way because it's just incorporated into who he is and who he believes himself to be. You know, at 63, he's not going to be like, you know what, these Democrats have a lot of great ideas and I'd like to pursue them. You know, he's not the type, unfortunately.
But we see later on in the book that a locksmith comes over to help him out and they hang out and have a beer, and the locksmith is African-American, and they get along well on a personal level.
Yeah.
He just doesn't kind of realize what his national politics will do to people in particular.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, too, about, you know, a lot of people in the South, maybe they think of a group of people a certain way. But then you get with the individual and, you know, two very different people might be having a great cup of coffee together and a nice conversation. And it's, I think individuals, people judge each other as people and come together as people. Whereas if you're looking at a group, it's different.
One of the people that does come check in on Lewis is his former brother-in-law, Frank.
Yes.
And he tolerates him because he brings leftovers, but Layla doesn't seem to enjoy Frank's presence.
Yeah. So Layla is just sort of this meek creature. And there's one person that she doesn't like, and it's Frank. And so the first time Frank comes over and the dog is there, she attacks him, kind of gets him by the ankle and by the pant leg and starts growling. And Lewis is shocked. And, you know, Frank didn't even know that Lewis had a dog. But yeah, I think that's sort of one of the mysteries Lewis has throughout the book. Like, you know, is Frank sort of the mild-mannered, nice guy that he always believed him to be? Or, you know, does he have some other side to him that Lewis has never really seen before? Or does the dog just hate this one person, you know?
Well, Frank says he's painting in his spare time because his wife reads books all the time. But what is he really doing?
Who knows?
I mean, John Wayne Gacy painted.
Yeah, it surprised me that Frank was like a bit of a mystery to me. Even as the book went on, I couldn't really ever pin him down. I was with Lewis. Yeah, is he this mild-mannered nice guy, or is he much more complicated and hiding his own secrets?
There's an idea that sets itself in Lewis's head. He has to know more about Harry Davidson, the dog guy's wife. Starts to have these reveries of what his future might be with her.
Yeah, I think to some extent it speaks to his isolation and how few people that he's actually come in contact with and socialized with since Ellen, his wife, has left. But, you know, he had this conversation with Harry, he got the dog, and he does just become oddly fixated on Harry Davidson's wife. And why, I don't really know. I couldn't figure it out either, except that, you know, from the very beginning, he seemed just curious about this woman. He wanted to at least lay eyes on her, and he didn't get to. And so, you know, he makes another detour back by to see if the dog giveaway is still going on and to see if he might catch a glimpse of this woman. And he questions whether she even exists. You know, did Harry Davidson just want to tell this story about his wife being allergic for whatever reason? And so, yeah, he becomes fixated on her and just has to see her. And that leads to, you know, some twists and turns throughout the book.
So how did Lewis find his way into your head?
Good question. I saw that same house that he did, and it had a free dog sign and some balloons. And I think the balloons to me, just because they're so often associated with children's birthday parties or, you know, baby showers, just seemed funny that these sad kind of deflating balloons were out there next to that sign. And I don't know, I just started thinking about what kind of person lived there, how many dogs there were, why he was giving them away or she. And I sat down to write it. I mean, it's such sort of a mundane thing, but I kept thinking about it. And as soon as I sat down to write it, Lewis just came and sort of started telling the story. And he's like, I'll tell you whose house it is. It's Harry Davidson's. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Lewis just kind of, you know, came in.
Did you know if it was going to be a novel right away or a short story or...
I didn't know what it would be. I mean, as I kept writing, I knew it was probably longer than a short story. You know, a short story might be 7,000 or 8,000 words. And Lewis seemed to be taking his time, really kind of showing me who he was and his life. You know, he spends a lot of time just thinking and bathing the dog and going to PetSmart. And as a short story, you know, that doesn't work. There has to be, you got to get in and out pretty quickly. You have to have something come to a head pretty quickly. And Lewis just kept wanting to hang around. So I just tried to follow him around and see what he would do next. And yeah, pretty quickly I saw that it was going to be a longer project, whether a novella or a novel.
Did you ever get frustrated with him, with all the stuff he was doing?
You know, I thought he was really funny. I mean, I think we all go around and we have these sort of just like, how do you say it? Just these reflexive thoughts, you know, and these negative thoughts that come out and just sort of prejudices that, but we never speak them, you know, we never act upon them. And Lewis often does. And I just kind of found that entertaining because he was just such a funny. I mean, it was funny to me. And yeah, he just really entertained me.
Lewis was a salesman by trade before he retired. But for a man who's supposed to make his living that way, he has zero ability for small talk with people, it seems.
It's very true. I've known some salesmen like that. My father is actually an insurance salesman. And it did not come naturally to him, I think, every day. He was good at it. And he ended up doing really well, but I do feel like every day was a struggle. And sort of like one of those jobs back in the day, you know, unless you had a profession, you're an accountant, you're, you know, a doctor, a lawyer, it was a job where you could support a family and do pretty well. And, you know, unless you wanted to work at a factory or something, but it could provide a nice, you know, white middle class, white collar middle class life for a family. But yeah, I'm sure a lot of the people who were salesmen weren't necessarily natural born salesmen. And Lewis, to me, was kind of like that.
The scene with at the bank where he gets a Kit Kat.
It's such a small thing. It's his birthday, and the teller sees his license and says, oh, it's your birthday, and gives him a little Kit Kat. She gets out the good candy in the good candy drawer, and he comments that it's not a white chocolate Kit Kat, which are his preference. And somehow just like this pleasant interaction went really sour pretty quickly. And I think that's typical of him. He doesn't really even see himself doing it. And before he can stop himself, he's turned what would have been a nice interaction into kind of a sour one. But yeah, he leaves the bank sort of baffled by himself. Like, why did I say that? Why did I, you know, why couldn't I have just taken the Kit Kat?
And he did mention early on that white chocolate Kit Kats were his favorite.
They are his preference.
So yeah. Where did that come from?
I don't know. I don't know. He commented that, you know, they were always coming out with new candy and they always would. I think, and that's like right at the beginning of the book when I feel like Lewis's joys in life and like the things that please him have gotten just so small. You know, he's still pleased by a cheeseburger or by this program or by a white chocolate Kit Kat, but because of just how isolated he is, his joys are very limited. And I think that kind of spoke to that.
Now, as he goes out and about with Layla, they go around the neighborhood, they go out for walks and rides and such. You see his blood sugar levels are affecting him at times, and he kind of spaces out and he has these little reveries every once in a while.
Yeah, he does. He kind of gets woozy. And there's something about when he's driving, you know, he feels like he doesn't know kind of how he went those 5 miles, became a blank. I think his blood sugar is affecting him a lot. And he's just sort of ignoring it and stopping at the, you know, corner store for more beer. And I think, you know, it's pretty clear that he does feel like hell most of the time. You know, he feels pretty miserable.
When he remembers back to his wife, Ellen, and their relationship, he has very little positive to say about it. And he calls her lazy and all manner of things. He doesn't seem to be able to see the good times.
Yeah, you know, there's the one he thinks a good bit about how they went to the fair together every year and how she would have, you know, have the man guess her weight and they would go to the free biscuit booth. And there were, I think, some moments that he remembered fondly. But I think, too, because Ellen has left and because he's all alone. And Ellen, he knows, has moved on. Frank even, you know, mentions the guy's name, the new guy.
Rick.
That, yeah, he can't help but be bitter. And so all of the positive sort of things that they shared and all of the lovely things that they'd had have just been sort of ruined and in his mind.
And he doesn't seem to care about what his part in all that was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's pretty typical of people. You know, if we were really honest about ourselves and the mistakes we made in each relationship and what we had done wrong or could have done better, it would be really hard to, like, just move through the world on a daily basis. And so I do think it's one of the reasons I'm so interested in just a first-person narrator and not switching points of view is because every point of view is very skewed. And we all just sort of live these dream lives that aren't necessarily accurate at all. And yeah, and Lewis's perspective is certainly skewed.
Can't remember which author told me, but the author said that they put a little bit of themselves in every single character in the book. So what bit of you found its way into Lewis?
Yeah, I guess I can be pretty grumpy. Lewis is just sort of, you know, the character that says things you would never say, but maybe you think. I think, too, when I was writing this book, it was the fall of 2016, and I was living on the Gulf Coast. I was living in Gulfport, actually, and I was working from home, and I was single at the time, and I think I, like Lewis, felt really isolated at that point in my life, too. I didn't have the community down there that I do in Oxford, for example, now where I live. And so I was just, yeah, feeling a little alienated. And so he was sort of somebody to hang out with me and to keep me company at that time.
just drinking together.
Yeah. Open another one, Lewis.
So Biloxi, of course, is on the Gulf of Mexico at the southern end of Mississippi. What makes the Gulf region unique when it comes to the other regions of Mississippi?
So I only lived on the coast for about a year, but I grew up with a bunch of relatives in Gulfport, and we would go down two or three times a year. And I was just really intrigued by the area because it was, you know, just 2.5 hours from Jackson. But the culture was so different and the thunderstorms were so different and everything. I don't know, my relatives down there, they all had open door policies. People would just pop in at all hours of the day and fix Bloody Marys and go to the beach. Nobody really seemed to work that much. I don't know if that was all just in like my child brain. But I was just, yeah, really intrigued by just cruising along Highway 90, my aunt's house, which was gone in Katrina, but she just lived right on the beach. And so we just sit in the living room and look out at the water. And it all just seemed so pleasant and so unlike, you know, Jackson, Mississippi.
So how does it compare to the hill country in Oxford?
Yeah, that's its own separate region, you know, the Delta, Central Mississippi, Oxford. Oxford has a lot to recommend it. It's getting a little expensive, but what I always say about Oxford is really the whole town, at least to me, revolves around the bookstore. You know, on the square, there are three bookstores. The owner of the bookstore used to be mayor. There's Thacker Mountain Radio. There's always just arts and music and culture and literary readings, and I love the art there.
Going back to his anticipation of the inheritance, he's been trying to get a hold of the lawyer who's handling this case, and his old attorney is no longer on the scene. He has now a young whippersnapper named Lucky.
That's right. So my husband is actually a lawyer named Lucky. And so I just sort of wrote him into the book, and I thought, oh, I'll change it later. You know, I wanted some just sort of kind of Mississippi country nickname. You know how so many of these lawyers, you know, have them. And I thought, yeah, well, I'll change it later. And Lucky wouldn't appreciate that anyway. And he loved it. he loved being a villain. Yeah, so that's how that came about.
Villainous by his absence.
Well, yeah. And two, you know, in my perception, I was like, oh, I figure lawyers always call their clients back, you know, and I asked a few lawyers and they were like, oh, no, you know, if I don't want to talk to them, no. And so I did, you know, run a few things by some lawyer friends, like when the inheritance and stuff like that happens or doesn't happen.
But can they bill for not picking up the phone?
Yeah.
Saw the phone ring for 3 minutes.
$100. Yeah.
With Lewis's kind of isolation and disconnected, it kind of reminds me of the general trend in America for people to become isolated. I remember the book Bowling Alone, and it seems like it's a big problem that we're dealing with as a nation.
I think so. I mean, I think as a nation, and I think it's particularly affecting older men. You know, there have been a lot of studies where when men get married, they sort of transfer all of their time and affections and all of the people that they do things with. It's their wife and their children, and their wife is the person they talk to. And, you know, they lose a lot of just sort of friendships over the years. And I was thinking, unless you maybe have hunting buddies or fishing buddies, which a lot of men do in the South. And even then, they don't talk about their emotions. I can't imagine it unless they just had way too much whiskey. But yeah, I think a lot of people are isolated. And I think it's especially a problem with Lewis and somebody like Lewis, who's lost his wife at this point and his brother's gone. And yeah, he doesn't really have anyone to talk to.
Recently, I've been reading about how women do so much of the emotional labor in a relationship, not only with their partner, but also maintaining relationships with other people, even their partner's family. And it's obvious that Ellen enjoyed spending time with Lewis's father where he didn't.
Exactly. Just thinking about my own family, my mom makes dinner plans and just tells my dad, on Friday night, we're going out with the so-and-sos. On Saturday, we've got this. And, you know, sometimes he complains, but he goes along with it. It gets him out of the house. It gets him out into the world and talking to people. And, you know, often, yeah, the women are the ones who do that legwork, who put together the reservations and say, we're going to meet these friends. And, you know, the men just kind of wait to be told what to do. I don't know. That's, you know, I'm sure there's some men who take on that role as well.
What did you learn in your previous books in the writing of them that helped you write this book?
That's a good question, because I think every book is so different. And this is only my second novel to finish and my second novel to publish. Short stories, you know, they're challenging in their own right, but they're short. And if they're not working, they're easier to give up on because you haven't spent months and months or years potentially, you know, writing and working on a project. It's hard to say what I've learned. I mean, I think I'm probably better at structure than I once was. But with my first novel, it occurs over a 3.5-day period. The last days of California, they're on a road trip, and it sort of happens in real time that we follow this family on this road trip. And Biloxi, too, I'm not sure exactly how short of a time it is, but it's probably within about a 2-week period that we hang around Lewis, perhaps a little longer. But I don't know how much I've learned. I wish, you know, I could say I learned so much from writing my previous book that I was able to cover a much larger time span and, you know, perhaps write from multiple perspectives and take big jumps and leaps in time. And maybe I'll try some of those things in the future. But I really do enjoy just kind of in real time seeing what a character's doing. And I think it takes a lot of bravery, and you're probably more prone to missteps if you're like, okay, let's jump ahead a month because that's when, you know, we need to be to see this. And yeah, it can get really tricky. So I don't know. I hate to say that I'm sort of writing in a safe way, but it is a way I feel comfortable with.
You're not putting stress on yourself worrying about like intensive plot points. You're really digging into the character, and you have to be with the character all the time to see when they're bored and when they're engaged and what's different and what are they thinking about at those times. And
yeah, that's a good point. They are more sort of intensive character studies than they are just trying to get from one point of the plot to the other and to make, you know, something happen. Something does happen, but usually, yeah, it's smaller things because I'm writing about real people and their real lives.
And we should look at the relationship he has with his daughter, Maxine. She had a little bit of a wild adolescence, and that kind of alienated him from her, it seems.
Yeah, Lewis, you know, he holds grudges, as is clear. And so Maxine did have, before she had gone off to college, she had sort of a wild streak, and she got into some trouble and crashed some cars and just, I think, really kind of wreaked havoc on this small family. And by the time she leaves, she goes off, you know, to college pretty far away and doesn't come home for a while. And I think Lewis is surprised to find her back in her hometown or very nearly so, and with a family. And he just is still holding on to, you know, the woman or the kid he knew and hasn't been able to fully accept her as the woman she is now.
She gives him a early birthday present of a Cheese of the Month Club. And I'll have to say, I got pears for 3 months from Harry and David's for a Christmas present this year, and mm-hmm. I loved it.
Yeah. I mean, stuff coming in the mail every month, it's great.
I don't see why he was so negative about it. It's great cheese.
So I think the previous year she'd given him an iPad, and, you know, Lewis is just so basic. You know, he said something like, she knows I only like cheddar and mozzarella, you know, and so there's all these, the cheese he gets is just some foreign thing, and he has to read all about it, and he's never heard of it, and he can't pronounce it. And so I think it's just sort of another offense, like, this girl doesn't know me at all.
And he still has his flip phone.
Yeah, he can't get on the internet, and he's very limited, you know. I don't know how well he texts. I think he can maybe receive texts, but yeah, he's pretty, what's the word, a Luddite.
he goes back over to Harry's house, and he has the worst trade craft in the world in his little reconnaissance mission.
Oh, gosh. Are you talking about, like, maybe the second time he goes over there?
Yeah.
And, yeah, he pretends to be trying to save her soul. And he doesn't really think it out at all. So, you know, he's out proselytizing and he has this little briefcase full of pamphlets. But once you ask someone if they've been saved and they say yes, you know, and she said yes, he didn't know at all where, you know, where do you go after that? I guess in some cases they'll still want to come in and pray for you. Yeah, I used to always answer that question, I'm a Catholic, and they would totally leave you alone then. Now I'm pretty lapsed, but that always turned them off. But yeah, he definitely does not think that action through.
So we'll leave things right there. We don't want to give away any more of the story because things do happen in Lewis's life. So we want to know, in your life, are you working on anything new?
I am working on a few essays and a couple of short stories that I really have sort of not been working on as recently. I've just been kind of publicizing this book, but I don't have a longer project in the works at this point. I was initially working on sort of a big novel, or what I thought would be like a big novel, and I couldn't write it, and so I stopped working on it to write Biloxi. And yeah, I'm thinking I hope to sort of go back to it and see if I can reimagine it in a way that it'll work and that I can capture the voices. It's about some women who are carriers of a disease who've been isolated on an island. And yeah, sort of a big ambitious project that I never could quite fully get a grasp on.
Well, I hope you can find your way back to it. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, me too.
Well, Mary, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing Biloxi with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Miller is the author of the novel Biloxi, which is published by LiveRight, an imprint of W.W. Norton. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.